This is Audible.
Audible presents The Good Hustle, Creating a Happy, Healthy Business with Heart by Dr. Polly McGee. Narrated by Dr. Polly McGee. My deepest gratitude to John McGee, without whom life would be less sweet. To the Lady Squire for bringing me into the journey. To Mwulumbah, Ubudan, Portland and Brooklyn. And to my girlfriends, Bhakti Yogis, teachers, gurus and virtuous friends, for appearing at exactly the right time to deliver your wisdoms. Remember, you don't have to change the world. You just have to make it better for someone else for a moment. Then repeat that action endlessly. Prologue. The Sacred in the Mundane. Ideas are funny things. Some of them whiz in and out. Visitors that remind you of the endless store of creativity within. Others are more persistent. They're bigger and more urgent in their calls to action. Writing The Good Hustle was definitely one of the latter. The idea for this book came to me while I was undertaking yoga teacher training at an ashram in tropical northern New South Wales. How I came to be at that ashram was a story in itself. By the end of 2014, I'd spent a couple of years working for big organisations, in roles that should have been the crowning moments of my career. Yet I certainly didn't feel that way and was on the point of chucking it all in and hoping I could make it working for myself. But I had niggling doubts and was worried that I wasn't going to get enough work if I went out on my own. It came time to commit to a new contract at the place I was working. I went around in circles in my head, then decided to stay on. A few weeks into the new contract, I knew I should have backed myself and left. But I could see the opportunity to put some behavioural change into action and make the best of my decision to stay. What if I actually tried to live each day like all of the spiritual teachings and readings recommended, in the present, surrendering the work to the divine and seeing it as service? Aside from quitting or whinging, I had no other option. Each day, before I took the 50-minute drive from my house to work, I would set an intention to simply be in the moment, to connect with everyone I met, and see how I could best serve them. Throughout this time, I was forced to admit to myself that my attachment to financial rewards and reputational standing, which I believed reflected my sense of value, were causing me great suffering. I'd pursued careers throughout my working life that legitimized me, that showed my status, that made me authoritative, useful, and important in the public eye. Yet none of these careers had given me lasting happiness. The more I got, the less I had. This suffering was self-made. I had to give up the desire for status, along with having any kind of control. It didn't change anything, except me. I began to loosen my grip, and I made it my mission to find opportunities to be of service. As a result, my world appeared more expansive, and I set about getting another project, my novel, Dogs of India, published. I was practicing discipline to make more time available to complete my paid work tasks as well as my side hustle. I'd consciously begun narrowing what I put into my head, what I was reading, what I was listening to and watching. If it didn't serve my spiritual development, then I didn't fill up my mind with it. When I look across my life with the uncensored voice of hindsight, I see that my decision-making process at that time had been run by my rampant sensory attachments with the pleasure and comfort button dialed up to 10. I believed that these sensations were what happiness was, but I couldn't get them to hang around. My rope bridge was unravelling, and I was clinging tighter and tighter to the desire for permanence. My year of living mindfully, doing something that was not my usual striving stab at pleasure, followed by a swift exit before embarking on the next bite at happiness, slowed me down. It gave me time to think, to focus on what this life I'd been rampaging through was all about. It gave me a taste for giving more and doing less for my own self-aggrandizement. It tuned me into my inner wisdom. The more I listened, the more I could distinguish the sound of this spokesperson for my true self from the louder, bullying voices of its ugly sisters self-criticism and self-doubt. I grew comfortable with my commitment to being in the moment and appreciating what I had now, not what I thought I could get around the next corner of my life. One spring day, I was driving back from a blissful yoga retreat. The weekend of meditation, kirtan, silence, and yoga with one of my best friends had left me feeling a sense of deep equanimity. My spiritual practice was continuing to grow, and my gratitude and contentment along with it. Out of the blue, I heard my inner voice telling me I was done with the work I was doing. I had learned the lesson of sticking with something and should take the next opportunity that was offered to me. The message was direct and unexpected. My last day at work was marked with a big red smiley face on my calendar, and I was quite determined to complete the job. I'd booked a trip to India to volunteer at a school for girls as a reward for my perseverance. But here I was, being instructed to start mentally packing my stuff in readiness for the next stage of my life. I recalibrated myself to a watching brief, curious to see what was going to happen next. Change came out of the blue. An offer of a short but lucrative consultancy job meant I'd have enough savings to be freed from having to earn money and could invest some time in developing my own projects. At the same time, a fortuitous conversation had led to a publishing deal for Dogs of India. Surrendering, listening to my inner voice, working from a place of divinity, asking for help was delivering. I felt happy, fulfilled, and motivated. In late December, as I was preparing for my imminent departure to India, a small ad popped up in my Facebook feed for a 2-month immersion yoga teacher training at a spiritual community set in an ashram near Byron Bay. I instantly knew without question that I had to go, that this was the experience that was calling me to prepare myself for the next adventure of my life, and I should cancel my other plans. Even with my appetite for agile life decisions, this one was left field. I decided to listen to my inner guide again and back my intuition. I cancelled my trip to India and headed north to the ashram. In so many things I do, I compare my approach to that of a method actor, diving in and living in character, Stanislavski style. Now it appeared I was going to become a yogi. But not new to live in a cave-style yogi. I was going to be an urban yogi, living a life with meaning and joy, through integrating the traditional restraints and observances of yogi life. When I talk about being a yogi throughout this book, it's a metaphor for a life where you're pointing yourself towards something bigger than you are, something with meaning that motivates grit and resilience in pursuing your goals to get to your higher self. But being a yogi doesn't happen overnight. I had to get ready. On the 1st of January, I gave up meat, fish, eggs, and booze in preparation for ashram life. By diving in with only 4 weeks to get my practice on, I didn't have time to think about the social impacts of this radical change of lifestyle, whether people would judge me or think I wasn't fun anymore. I had such an attachment to being a foodie and my cork-popping, cocktail-shaking life, and if I'd overthought it, I definitely would have struggled, suffered, and faltered. Instead, I just became yogi, and so all of my choices followed this new path of living. It was easy to say no because I knew how hard it would be if I went to the ashram unprepared mentally for the physical demands. By being what I wanted to become, I became it. In Buddhism, you meditate on the Buddha as though you possess all of the qualities of a fully enlightened being and behave with complete compassion. You aren't the Buddha yet. But in doing this practice, you're acknowledging that within all of us, there is Buddha nature, the capacity for enlightenment in this lifetime. It's much easier to do nothing if you feel there's no way you can reach the finish line. By acknowledging what's possible, finding the sacred in the mundane, the daily acts that stitch our days, weeks, and lives together, I set my mind to living the right way, accepting there would be plenty of wrong paths taken along the journey. This undoubtedly accelerated and deepened my spiritual experience. It also became my earliest foray into growth mindset. The decision to take 2 months out to live yogi after a life of striving was life-changing. The experience of becoming completely immersed in spirituality, spending hours each day practicing yoga, reading ancient spiritual texts, meditating, chanting mantra, living as a yogi in service to all sentient beings. It was home. I'd always thought it sounded really corny when people say that. But what it means is that we feel what it is like to be our true selves. I felt like my inner voice was sitting on a rock by the river's edge, gently asking what took me so long. I'd found my Dharma, what it meant to give value and feel I was the essence of me. I don't mean being a yoga teacher or any specific task, but immersing myself in spirituality in a practical everyday sense. I'd been drawn to Eastern spirituality and philosophy since I was a child, but I had no outlet to explore that in the non-religious household I grew up in, and no role models to guide me. This is an important point on how we find our paths. It can be hard to know how to apply something you read in a book to your own life. Author, academic and yogi Stephen Cope describes finding your tribe as encountering a full expression of kindred Dharma. That's a nice way to think of those role models. Watching someone else blossom is the trigger for our own inner seeds to germinate. Hence the need to find those teachers and sangha to surround yourself with a spiritual cheer squad to help you grow. Living in Dharma, living with meaning and applying the eight limbs of yoga to my own life had a profound impact on my happiness. I stopped looking outwards to everything and everyone for validation and approval, stopped trying to be the best and the smartest, and went within to try and build some discipline in my own mind. The 8 weeks at the ashram, and the month before that when I started being yogi, and the year before that when I'd consciously practiced discipline and faith in the surrender, were the beginning of a year of confidently following my heart and mind, rather than being wagged by the tail of reaction and attachment. Perhaps it was my experience working with entrepreneurs and startups that made the connection between the eight-limbed path of yoga and the journey of the entrepreneur appear so logical. There seemed an absolute synergy between the two missions, and when the idea of combining the two as a method of building heart-centered businesses came to me, I couldn't unsee it. The coupling kept popping up, and the deeper I dug during my immersion in the ashram and the weeks that followed, the more I read, the more I sat and thought, the more it resonated that when the desire to do something bigger was overlaid with the motivation driving entrepreneurial and business activities, a powerful union emerged. Further study of the teachings of the Buddha Dharma pointed to a new model of spiritually embodied business behavior and leadership. It became clear to me that once the mind was understood through the discipline of meditation and self-study advocated in the ancient yogic texts, the approach to business could be liberated from some of the attachment and suffering entrepreneurs looking to establish heart-centered business ventures often felt. Like many of my clients, I want to be part of enterprises that have a bigger motivation than money and success. Sure, those things are great byproducts, but for me, I want to really love my projects because I see and feel the impacts the work is having on others. I want to be of service to all sentient beings, not just humans, but animals, plants, the ocean and earth, from massive to tiny. All matter matters. Sometimes that alone is the reason to begin something, rather than a profit motive. In a world where even the best business ideas with a surefire market trajectory can, should and do fail, the idea of starting up an enterprise or taking a role based on being of service, values and love isn't that crazy. You may have come to this book with an idea for a business, service or product, but not know how to go about bringing it to fruition. Or you may have a longing for change in your life and pick this up looking for some pointers on how to identify what it is you want to do, ready to get going when the lightning strikes. Either way, you're preparing the ground of your mind as a fertile environment to seed an idea and bring it to fruition. If you have a yearning in life, a restlessness in your consciousness that you feel is unmet, this book is for you. It's not a book that seeks to balance your work or life. It's a book about the totality of us and what we are and do and why. It's not a book that will spit out a business plan at the end or give you endless templates and tick box quizzes to execute. There's already a mountain of excellent resources available in the virtual and real world to help you with those tasks. Nor is this a book of spiritual materialism and positive thinking-driven personal development. Although I am going to spend as much, if not more, time focusing on you as I am on the business. This is a book that I hope will give you the most important tool of all. An understanding of the role your mind plays in the way you experience the world and who you are driven to serve. It will help you discover what that might look and feel like, and how you can scale your new focus into a marketable idea to create a good hustle business, or be present in and for your organization and co-workers. The Good Hustle is a book to help bridge that gap for many of us who identify with a spiritual path and who don't see that path as separate to our work, but as the center of everything we do. If I was to create a persona of the person likely to pick up this book, it would look something like this. You've spent some time, probably a lot of time, and no doubt with significant investment on various journeys of self-discovery. Perhaps this has been to improve a singular element of your life, love, money, career, or health, for example. Or perhaps it was because you had a niggling feeling that you weren't complete. You have a fundamental desire to change the way you feel about yourself. You may also want to change that thing you do to earn an income stream so it aligns with the totality of you and your values. You're probably juggling myriad responsibilities and activities, some intellectual, some physical, some emotional, some hormonal, and you have an interior space that's locked down, blocked up, a tear against the door of yourself, where the parts of you that are your greatest critic ferment happily, bubbling to the surface when you least need to hear them, which is, of course, constantly. This critical self-dialogue has been part of what might be holding you back from pushing ahead with your business idea, even though you have a killer idea and a gut feeling that you just need to do it and the time is right. You need some tools. You need some straight-up advice. You need some support for your internal emotional compass. And you don't want to be sold to, patronized, mansplained, or assaulted by the subtle aggression of self-development gurus. If this is you, then we are in the right place, at the right time, and this is the right book. I want to show you the tap that turns on the flow of all of the good things into your being, the sparkle, the creativity, the frisson of authenticity, the step full of spring for your idea. I want to take your ideas out of the too hard basket and drop them into the one labeled, let's do this. I want you to find the effortlessness of self-love and fulfillment, of being, not doing. I want you to give benefit to others as your default setting and sign off on a permanent permission note to being enough. Working on and in business where the hustle is inherently good is a pathway to achieving some of that. It's business. It's a way of being. But it's also who you are. And so throughout this text, I'm going to weave in some personal insights to illustrate the experience. The method acting of being yogi has become my lifestyle. Whenever I begin to worry about things I can't control or find myself making endless future plans, I stop and focus on what I'm doing at that moment, reminding myself to leave everything else alone. I try to do my dharma day after day, and the feeling of general equanimity prevails. It doesn't stop the suffering when things happen to trip you up, but it puts the suffering in context for the long game of this life. You don't hold on to the trip and make it a big drama. You get up, laugh, and point to the mud all over you and keep going. It's the kind of suffering you're happy to fight for and endure, knowing it's impermanent. Saying no comes much easier to me now. I don't worry about my reputation or whether people like me or if my decisions are going to make other people happy. Each choice is made through the lens of service, and I just do what I do with as much compassion and love as I can muster and work towards mustering more. The reduction in highs and lows means there is so much more productive time in the day. I'm not saying the occasional nap doesn't slip in, but it's a conscious rest rather than an escape from the world. There's no longer a desire to numb out with food, booze, and other experiential pleasures. So I save plenty of money, which means I can devote more time to creativity for the sake of good hustle and not simply to make money at all costs. I have all the riches I need, with no requirement to look outside. The Good Hustle is a book all about you and me and us and them as one. It's also a book about being and becoming the best you can be, and measuring this with simple metrics, like your capacity to love, serve and connect. So, welcome to The Good Hustle, a revelation and revolution, combining the ancient wisdom of yogis and Buddhas with the contemporary genius of living and working in a lean, agile, heart-centered way. Introduction. Becoming awake involves seeing our confusion more clearly. Chogyam Trungpa, Buddhist monk, meditation master and author. Australian palliative care nurse Bronnie Ware, in her book The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, says that the number one regret her dying patients express is the wish to have had more courage to live a life true to themselves, not the life others expected of them. The words sound easy, but the application of them, once we start to unpack the ideas, is incredibly difficult. If we're true to our authentic desire, what is it that we want? Once the question is posed, we need to begin the hunt within for the answers. And we need to be really brave in pursuing our own truths. The deeper we look inside and begin to know who we really are and honour that knowledge, the more we'll aspire to do what is most beneficial and the greater courage we'll have to make the right choices for us and others. So here are the questions we are going to pose as we start this adventure together. What if we're enough just as we are? What if there is no need to strive, to achieve, to crush the opposition, to get to the top, or to succeed in that traditional way of measurable gains? What if our sense of self is the sense that all we are is part of a greater whole? What if we can create heart-centered businesses or enterprises that allow us to do something we love, that are sustainable and viable and serve the market and our customers to our and their higher good? What if we could pursue endeavours that also leave us feeling well, not exhausted, stressed and anxious? And the big existential what if? What if there isn't a destination to happiness that comes from striving and doing? What if everything is simply a continuum of curiosity and becoming? These questions and hypotheses will be tested throughout this book by combining the practice of creating lean startups with the ancient wisdoms found in the teachings of yoga and meditation. Not a combination usually found in MBA or small business courses, but one far more common than you would think in the practice of entrepreneurs who understand that all transactions happen in the mind before they happen in the marketplace. The book is structured in four sections. The first, heart-centered, tackles the tension of combining spirituality with business and the shadow issue of our own deep-seated lack and the fear that holds us hostage. Once we've begun the conversation with ourselves, it's time to look for our innate good hustle motivation in part two, Desperately Seeking Dharma, an investigation of the idea of Dharma and how we can best deliver service to others throughout our lives. Part three is where we be it till we are it with the Good Hustle Playbook, a bundle of mindful business practices you can use to conceive and implement your good hustle. And finally, in part four, we travel along the path to enlightenment with the Yoga of Business, an application of lean startup principles aligned to the Yoga Sutras and Buddhism's eight worldly dharmas as a way of preparing to launch your sustainable, successful good hustle into the world. I believe in applying the practice of yoga holistically. With a simple set of disciplined practices, yoga can disarm the nuclear arsenal of our self-critical minds and reactive behaviours, turning them and us into powerful forces for good. While we've adopted yoga asana practice in the West and are now beginning to see the significant impact a physical practice can have, there is a need to apply the full expression of yoga to the places where we concentrate so much of the effort and energy of our lives, like our careers. We need to be able to create those fleeting moments of calm that we experience on the mat or the cushion and infuse them into our 24-hour days. We need to visit or revisit the fundamentals of yoga as a system of knowledge for navigating being human and apply it systematically and holistically. So we live yogi, and that includes the yoga of business. Meditation similarly fits within the practice of yoga. In fact, it is inextricable from both the eight-limbed yogi's path and every step of Buddha's eightfold path. Yoga and Buddhism in the West are positioned not as religions, but as systems of philosophical interrogation and practice. Yoga is, however, still a system deriving from the Hindu religion and is closely connected with all aspects of Hindu Dharma and much of Indian culture. Buddhism also shares many similarities with religion, even though the Dalai Lama often refers to it as a science or philosophy. Today, yoga is most known for its asanas or postures, which are the most visible and outward form of the system. Buddhism is known as the tradition of meditation, as in the more popular forms of Buddhist meditation, like Zen and Vipassana. This is a quirk of the West that says more about us and how we've interpreted these disciplines than it does about the true nature of yoga, which is traditionally defined as meditation, or calming the disturbances of the mind, not as asana, which is taught merely as an aid to meditation. I'm giving you this micro version of the roots of yoga and Buddhism to set up where most of us will be in our interpretations and understandings of the vast body of yogic and Buddhist teachings. You don't need to be a purist or a hybridist or anyist to get the gist of how they're going to be incorporated into your path of enlightenment in the good hustle. If you're not a cat who sat on a mat, yoga or meditation, you're still perfectly prepared for what comes next. If you have a deep belief in a Christian, Jewish, Hindu or Muslim God, or are a raging atheist, then you are likewise not going to be excluded or offended by the good hustle and its view on incorporating your version of spirituality into your business idea and merging both into a life that is healthy, happy and full of heart. Part 1. Heart-centered. This is the age of doing work that matters. If you feel like what you do doesn't make an impact, no amount of money will keep you there. Gala Darling, author, speaker, international playgirl. The businesses I'm talking about are designed around love and devotion to customers, around being in service. You aren't trying to manifest a diamond necklace to bring happiness. You are polishing the diamond of your essential self to find the contentment that comes from living holistically. The God of Small Business Things. Business and spirituality aren't separate. I want to address this issue at the start, as it's something that I struggled to articulate clearly to myself for a long period of time. The same awkwardness that can arise when trying to find the words to express your version of God or the divine is amplified when mixed in with the often undivine world of work and business. There's a widely spread belief that spiritual businesses are the evolution of what used to be called New Age businesses, which in itself now seems a kooky and antiquated term. New Age was code for some kind of tie-dyed hippie enterprise that was floating around in the ether, dripping with crystals and fairy dust, and certainly not rooted in any serious or robust business practice. The New Age business was kryptonite to the Gordon Gekko mode of business in the 80s, where money was the underpinning of an era built on ego, assets, and ruthless acquisitions. The reaction to the soulless and exploitative nature of that time in Western culture was the emergence of the spiritual and motivational movement, where the icons of merging success with a higher purpose were the emerging empowerment celebrities Tony Robbins and Oprah Winfrey. With mainstream media-savvy champions, spirituality got a makeover, one where success and soulfulness could coexist and still maintain the razzle-dazzle of a sales convention where everyone was a winner. Positive thinking and speaking prevailed. This is a very loose and anecdotal timeline of the cultural progression of how a certain view of spirituality was embedded in our understanding. Without doubt, the most significant contribution to having a cake and manifesting it too was the publication of The Secret by Rhonda Byrne. A book and then movie that not only told us we could be spiritual, but also gave us permission to use the mystical power of the universe to provide us with endless material wealth. This idea played beautifully into the fear of not being or having enough in a world addicted to instant gratification and consumption. The secret taught us that we could manifest anything if we were clear on our intention and handed over control to the universe, which was inferred to be a massive energetic Walmart that would spontaneously deliver our heart's desires. Of course, this was simply more of what renegade monk and author Chogyam Trungpa would disparagingly call material spiritualism. It was Gordon Gekko manifested through the longing for possessions to fill the well of emptiness so many people felt. The secret spawned an enormous sector of spiritual marketers who took the manifesting business to new heights of aspiration with billions of dollars in book sales and workshop revenues. This movement also built a concept of happiness based around more stuff, more of the things that are, in my belief, the cause of so much of our present-day suffering. It portrayed personal happiness as the result of personal acquisition, not as the result of giving and working towards the happiness of others. The work needed was all pointed outwards, and because of that, there was an all-care, no-responsibility clause. If the happiness that all those other manifestors had found didn't miraculously appear in your driveway, round your neck, or on your finger, it was because you were doing it wrong. Which, of course, for so many people was an inbuilt shortcut to failure, anxiety, and proof of not being enough. And the cycle of material life continued. What better snake oil to sell to a culture gorging on possessions and status than a brand of spirituality that netted more possessions and status? Genius, right? A couple of decades later, there's an increasing awareness that our mass consumption is having a serious impact on people and the environment, and there is more suffering around than ever. We are looking for connection, for compassion, and for meaning that's beyond the individual, and a desire to connect that with our own spirituality. The central message of the Good Hustle is that all business and work can be conducted in a way that connects the action with what we can describe as something bigger than you. It doesn't have to be a spiritual business. You don't have to be a yogi or a vegan raw foodist or live in a blue zone to be of benefit. Although you may well be rocking the pants out of that lifestyle. If so, all power to you. I'm not insisting on you accessorizing or purchasing anything to get started. Except this book, of course. But you know, libraries are free. The purpose of integrating spiritual teachings and lean startup principles is giving you the capacity to create a business, enterprise, organization, venture, co-op, or for that matter, job, that makes you feel motivated, joyful, and connected. For this to be sustainable, if you aren't heading straight to a cave and accepting offerings into a bowl, you need to be able to create enough revenue for the business to survive and thrive, and you and your staff along with it. To do so, you need to have built your good hustle on the foundation of a realistic and measurable market that needs what you're offering at a price that covers costs and that you meet and hopefully exceed the expectation of your customers. The rules are the rules are the rules when it comes to the equation that enables sustainable growth, whether spirituality is present in your business plan or not. Opportunity plus meeting sufficient market demand plus sale equals revenue. But loudly, proudly and unashamedly, the differentiator is that the businesses I'm talking about are designed around love and devotion to customers, around being in service. You aren't trying to manifest a diamond necklace to bring happiness. You're polishing the diamond of your essential self to find the contentment that comes from living holistically. This life of joy and meaning all happens in the world as we know it, not in a mythical place where the stresses and strains of your life disappear, the children are quiet and angelic, the traffic flows, and your groceries miraculously appear in the pantry. It's the same old life, same old world, same old issues, but with a radically revisioned approach to how you react to them. It's not just business that will become spiritual. It's everything that you do, all juiced up to be of service to others. No need to rush out and burn your vision board, kids. The repetitive themes and longings of your life will provide rich clues to where you're heading if you currently feel rudderless. Spoiler alert, Your vision board will not end up a catalogue of future purchases and status symbols. The success of your good hustle will not be measured by the number of zeros in your bank balance. It will be felt in your heart and in your connection with the infinite amount of sentient beings, human and other, that you're unconditionally loving through your work. Ain't no vision board big enough to accurately represent that. Growing pains. What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to do? Familiar questions. Most, if not all of us, have been confronted with a request to select our futures on demand. Perhaps in high school, when you were trying to decide which elective class would define your entire future. Or perhaps even earlier, when parents and relatives were forensically searching for clues as to which of your childhood whims might transform into a career. When I was really young, I wanted to be a writer. My first book, lovingly hand-bound by my mother, was about a dog that had a tongue made of bacon. I was obviously ahead of the curve as a four-year-old, intuitively understanding the bacon zeitgeist even then. At seven, I wanted to be a lady of the night, as it was euphemistically referred to in my family. It seemed a very appealing career choice at that age, to be allowed to get all dressed up with epic hair and makeup and no one telling you to go to bed at 7 p.m. And you could have tattoos. I would secretly pack a bag at night and lie in bed planning my escape to King's Cross, where I knew the night ladies hung out, with its bright lights and what seemed to be limitless potential for adventure. From my earliest memories, I coveted tattoos and marvelled at those dudes, and occasionally dames, who were allowed to have them, and their effortless cool. In my family, they were strictly denounced as the denominator of commonness and vice. I had no idea of what a prostitute did, or what sex even was. The envious and innocent pre-internet child that was me interpreted those women as free spirits, out late at night without their parents, expressing themselves on their own terms. Feminists, if you will. Everything I wasn't at age seven. I admit these were a pretty kooky set of goals and observations of the world around me, and the travails of sex work were completely beyond my young mind. Without any kind of reality filter, however, I was obviously drawn to an embodied world of service and aesthetics. As I hit my teens, the other career I really wanted to pursue was hairdressing. Again, service, aesthetics, cool hair, and tattoo opportunities, but no sex required. Like my other work aspirations, Mum shut this down vigorously on the too common ground. Don't get me wrong, this wasn't a mean-spirited killjoy motif. Like most parents, what Mum wanted for me was a life and education better than her own. I was raised to believe I could have and do anything I put my mind to, and the scaffolding of this was education as emancipation. Obediently taking on the values and beliefs of my parents, this is where I undoubtedly began my decades-long tussle with identifying and living my Dharma, versus doing what I believed others thought was right for me in order to please them. What we do is a significant part of how we describe ourselves, and herein lies one of the fundamental problems of our time. If we aren't our work and our incomes, our status and our ambitions, our ownership and our achievements, who and what are we? And what is our purpose? In recent years, this question has shifted into another loaded way of asking what you want to be when you grow up. What is your passion with a capital P? Or sometimes your equally capitalized purpose. Passion and purpose are, quite frankly, another sneaky way of asking about the nature of who we are, defined externally through what we do and what status that confers. Passion is personal. It's something we really should know, the inference being otherwise we are lacking a lust for life or something more fundamental. Another lucrative industry has emerged around helping people to find their passion and purpose through various self-styled self-help gurus. And in the words of Alanis Morissette, isn't it ironic? Who better to be able to know what it is we love and are passionate about than us, and not some external party? Double Alanis points for irony if you've noticed that this is also a book that you had to purchase about helping you find your passion and purpose. But as we think we are not enough, we look to and pay others to do the big reveal on ourselves. The real irony is that we won't speak, hear, or act on our truths while we are caught in an endless cycle of internal criticism, comparison, and invalidation of our ideas. Our passions are muted by deep longings for love, acceptance, and understanding from outside. I now know my childhood careers were not the path to happiness and self-realization I thought they were. But there were elements in that mini-me wisdom of what motivates me to this day. There was no one in my family, neighborhood, or community that modeled a life I aspired to. That spiritual kin I mentioned in the beginning of the book were missing in guiding and validating my choices. I had no idea what I wanted to be, although I was very clear on the type of career and higher education others thought would be suitable for me. If only I had known then that I shouldn't have been searching for a title on a business card. I should have been looking for a feeling, a sense of well-being, a jigsaw piece slipping snugly into a hole as a clue to my true nature of self. Those of us who can only give a vague wish list of our passions and purpose, or worse, who have no firm answer, or who want to do things with no visible commercial outcomes, like be an artist or musician, often find ourselves viewed as second-class doers, subordinate to a class of people who are born with a vocational spoon in their mouths, destined for something definable somewhere, with a clear economic benefit. I violently envied those people who effortlessly knew what they wanted. No shadows of doubt, just a clear runway to self-actualization. The worst thing about big P questions, when unable to be swiftly and surely answered, is that they cause real anxiety. I remember vividly the rising panic I felt through most of my 20s and early 30s as I searched for my purpose like I was ransacking a sale bin. I tried on career after career, experiencing a brief euphoria as I convinced myself I had finally found my purpose and passion. Then I'd quickly crash with the bleak realization that whatever job I was doing was just as flawed and unsatisfying as everything else I'd done. And I'd done a lot. Just in case you thought I was some kind of quitter, here is a selection of the jobs I have wholeheartedly thrown myself into since launching my adult life of finding my Dharma. Chef, hairdresser, sandwich hand, commercial shop fitter, window dresser, fashion retailer, call center agent, cafe owner, adult film reviewer, political lobbyist, digital strategist, farmhand, artist in residence, radio presenter, public servant, speechwriter, innovation grants manager, IP manager, not-for-profit co-founder, copywriter, web builder, academic, author, yoga teacher, social media trainer, strategic marketing lead. It was indeed a watershed moment as I scraped the bottom of that sales bin and finally surrendered to perhaps never knowing what my purpose was, and that this ignorance was okay. Surrender instantly made me feel better and lighter. I didn't need to know my passion and purpose. I just had to enjoy what I was doing right now. Just focus on the task at hand. A frayed knot of beliefs and self-criticism unraveled with the simple epiphany that I was spending all my time yearning for a future that didn't exist, worrying over it, building a complex second life around, well, nothing, while flagrantly squandering the life I was living in the pursuit of a hypothetical future life. Damn right. Plus, if I didn't have to do this mythical something that was my passion and purpose, well, I could actually do anything. The world opened up as I awakened to my potential. Getting a lot of tattoos also helped. That sounds a little glib, but in truth, the one constant since my childhood has been this inexplicable love of tattoos. And not just a small, discreet rose on a buttock never to be seen by the world. I wanted lots and lots of tattoos everywhere. While everything else I was striving for seemed elusive and meaningless, as I kept striving, I rebelled against my own internal critic who cautioned me that making permanent inky choices would spell disaster when I finally happened upon my one true career that demanded a clean and proper body. That scared voice, it's fair to say, lost the battle. And inadvertently, I won the war. By marking myself permanently, in an act of celebration, I reminded myself every day who I essentially was and had been for as long as I could remember. Let me reiterate that this was a completely unconscious act. You couldn't have found a less self-aware, mostly self-loathing human than I was in my 20s. But as my arms and other bits became more colourful and covered, I inhabited the skin I was in, and because of this, I pushed myself into career places that I'd always been told tattooed women would never be allowed. This all seems a little hard to fathom now when you see an endless stream of proud tattooed women in all walks of life. When I first started out, especially working in rural and regional Australia, I saw myself as a self-appointed spokesmodel for the tattooed woman. I believed I could be an ambassador for the skills, professionalism and compassion of my people, reversing the images and stereotypes I'd grown up with of tattooed people as criminal ne'er-do-wells. And thus, in the most confounding and roundabout way, I set myself on the path of a life of service, of being an exemplar. I should have read the Good Hustle playbook about getting the self-love part down pat first before I forged out on my mission. But hindsight is a fairly useless skill for living in the moment. Grow your brain. There's one more fairly significant discovery I made that I believe freed me from the cycle of striving and disappointment, and that was learning a concept known as growth mindset. Growth mindset straddles applied psychology and educational theory. I was introduced to it when I was doing some research for a startup edtech company that was building educational programs for preschool kids. I was tasked with cataloguing all of the research that had been globally undertaken on the topic. And me being me, I not only catalogued it, I read a lot of it as well. And it completely blew my mind. I mentioned earlier how surrendering to the realization that I should stop my fruitless search for my purpose brought on a massive sense of relief. I didn't have to know what it was. I could do anything. I didn't realize it at the time, but right there I had had my very own growth mindset moment. So what is it? The concept of a growth mindset was developed by psychologist and Stanford University professor Carol Dweck through her research programs and book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success. Growth mindset research and in-class testing over many years demonstrated a major positive change to learning capacity in children and adults who applied a growth mindset instead of a fixed mindset to their process of learning and skills acquisition. This change was a direct result of being taught the tools to approach tasks using a mindset that encouraged elements like collaboration, experimentation, effort and failure as integral to the learning journey. People will differ in their initial talents and aptitudes, interests or temperaments, but everyone can change and grow through application and experience. Having a growth mindset isn't just learning related. It also has a profound effect on personal relationships, professional success, and many other dimensions of life. The greater impacts of growth mindset on creating mentally resilient children, who in turn become mentally resilient adults, is why it is so important to teach growth mindset thinking as early as possible and incorporate it into a child's approach to learning and living. A mindset, according to Professor Dweck's definition, is a self-perception that people hold about themselves and the larger world. Holding the belief that you are intelligent or unintelligent is a simple example of a mindset. People may also have a mindset related to their personal or professional lives, a fixed binary or bias, like being good or bad at a task or role. In the fixed mindset worldview, individuals believe that basic personal traits and situations, like talent and intellect, are permanent states, and these are predetermined markers of success. You either have talent or you don't. If, for instance, you believe you are dumb at certain things, say maths or language learning, you won't attempt them and continue to perpetuate the idea and subsequent reality of that belief. Conversely, with a fixed mindset worldview, if you do have a particular skill or talent, this has to be maintained at all costs and needs to be proven to the world over and over, causing stress and anxiety from striving to maintain the status quo, rather than further exploring, developing or growing that skill set. The antidote to the fear-based, limited approach of fixed mindset is adopting a growth mindset. With a growth mindset, people believe that effort creates talent and skills are learned over time through trial and error. The capacity to positively fail, where individuals learn from their mistakes and use that learning as a plank of mental growth towards achieving the skill, is a key difference in the growth mindset approach. Strongly underpinning growth mindset is resilience or grit. As learning a new skill takes time and will inevitably involve setbacks along the way, resilience and perseverance need to be developed and sustained. Students who use a growth mindset approach have been shown to learn more and embrace challenges and failures enthusiastically as opportunities rather than setbacks. Instead of relentlessly hammering them with the idea of finding passion and purpose, we should instead be indoctrinating children into learning the art of a growth mindset. I support Professor Dweck's implication that a fixed mindset is the default for most people, and add it to my belief that institutions like schools and universities strongly perpetuate the idea that talent is somewhat inherent and needs to be amplified rather than grown from scratch. In my own experience, I was told from a young age at school and at home that I had no skill in maths or science and basically shouldn't bother pursuing them. In the fixed mindset worldview, my talents were in the softer skills of English and home economics, so I abandoned all efforts at numbers and instead made it my mission to be the best at the things I could already do. I imagine now what it would have been like if instead of being told I had no skill, I was told I had no skill yet. And that as I appeared to be struggling with maths, I should look for a different approach to working out the problems. This is the genius of growth mindset. It tells you not to give up and that you don't have to know the answer. You have to find the answer. And you will, in time, with effort. The other sneaky boomerang about having a fixed mindset is that all the things you are good at, your God-given talent, as it were, have to be demonstrated over and over and over for the rest of your life. The theory being that if you fail at the few things you excel at, you are really a failure. A perfect example of seeing this play out in life is with professional athletes. So often they've been identified as talented in their particular discipline in childhood and told their whole life they are special because of this one attribute. It defines them. And so when their careers end, they find themselves unable to forge a satisfying or fulfilling life after sport. And in some cases, the consequences are disastrous. They simply haven't acquired the skills of a growth mindset, which would enable them to ask, what's next? How can I grow my brain now? When you apply this type of thinking to the passion and purpose dilemma, it gets a lot simpler. If you can learn to do anything with determination and sheer hard work, then your passion is in maintaining that curiosity. If your passion for work is in giving and being of service or benefit, working for others and creating your happiness through that prism, that can be applied to any action, from the most mundane to the most significant. That would change the whole childhood conversation. From what do you want to be when you grow up, to who do you want to benefit? Work. What is it good for? It is an unspoken and intrinsically accepted part of contemporary first world culture that nearly all of us have a point of entry into the workforce, however that job is defined. We then spend the majority of our lifetime doing, to generate wealth for ourselves and our families, to fund the ever-escalating task of living comfortably, or for many, simply to survive. Apple founder the late Steve Jobs famously said, "You've got to find what you love. Your work is going to fill a large part of your life, and the only way to be truly satisfied is to do what you believe is great work. And the only way to do great work is to love what you do." He has his own Alanis Morissette moment of irony. Jobs was renowned as a terrifying and intimidating tyrannical boss who sent many an idealistic employee into deep states of despair after thinking that a job at Apple with one of the world's best known entrepreneurs was the answer to their quest for passion and purpose. And therein lies the rub. Our education from an early age points us towards attaining knowledge and skills to work for and in someone else's business. Rarely are you groomed to think independently, entrepreneurially, to win and lose and lose and win, knowing that this is all part and parcel of the rich and gratifying impermanence of taking your ideas to market. Instead, we learn compliance, dependence, subservience, the rule of control and command. We learn how to fit in, and in many cases disappear, with a reliable income, endless acquisition of stuff and status being traded for finding ourselves. Did someone say fixed mindset environment? How are you feeling right now, reading this? Is this empty striving part of your reality? Are you feeling all defensive about your choice of a salaried mortgage life and the pinch of golden handcuffs? Don't get me wrong, this is the reality for most of us. In Buddhism, it's said that we are all born with an awakened state of mind, known as Buddha nature. Wisdom, love, kindness and compassion are our true natures of being. Frustration, jealousy, guilt, shame, anxiety, greed, competitiveness and so on are experiences we learn through the influences of our culture, our families, education and our friends. These notions are then reinforced by personal experience. It is a universally applied affliction that we have to work hard to firstly have awareness of and then harder to reverse. My criticism here is that we are groomed for suffering and attachment from infancy. We are taught how to look for the title and career that will define us, and we literally pay for it for the rest of our lives. This is the Buddhist definition of samsara, and it is the condition of being human. From the earliest stages of our lives, our innate hunches about what brings us time, stand still, joy, and triggers an understanding of who we are influenced by accepted norms. We have to grow up. We have to be stable. We have to have and do a job. And eventually we have to own a house, acquire a partner, and continue on the race for status. This is our broad span of normative benchmarks, from which deviation is not celebrated and championed until success is well and truly established. Few people are cheering in the corner of the gal or guy who quits their salary job to pursue a crazy idea to change the world through love and humanity. In my client's experience, one of the great motivators for starting a business or pursuing a creative idea is to transition work from being an unlovable drudge to something that catapults you out of bed into a day and often night of empowered, satisfying activity. The love part that Steve Jobs talks of is unquestionably one of the perfect metaphors relating to work and your own venture. In love's full sense of being unconditional, it encompasses the joyfulness and the drudgery, the highs and the horrors, and mediates them all with a sense of total acceptance of any situation. And right here, in the words of Steve Jobs, and in my own breakup with the search for a purpose, is where the good hustle merges with the yoga of business. Yoga to the people. If you have only encountered yoga as physical postures or asana in a yoga class, then it's time to meet the bigger yoga family. Just a brief introduction, as we'll be spending plenty of quality time with yoga and its eight limbs later in this book. Yoga's history is somewhat mysterious, the oral transmission of many of its sacred texts and the secretive nature of its teachings. What we know is that yoga can be traced back over 5,000 years, and that as a science, it has evolved and continues to have relevance across cultures through innovation, practice and development. With origins in northern India, the word yoga was first mentioned in a sacred text called the Rig Veda. The Vedas were a collection of texts containing songs, mantras and rituals to be used by Brahmins, the Vedic priests. The most renowned of all the yogic scriptures is the Bhagavad Gita, composed around 500 BC. The Yoga Sutras, written by Patanjali, were the first systematic presentation of yoga, breaking it down into an eight-limbed path, pointing seekers to the stages of obtaining samadhi or enlightenment. Patanjali was never keen on the sutras being viewed as a definitive prescriptive work. Rather, he saw the eight limbs as an evolution in collaboration with other sages and yogis. Obviously a totally growth mindset kind of guy and a lover of the minimum viable product methodology. More on that later. Systems of yoga continue to be developed in India through the exploration of physical and spiritual connections and body-focused practices, which became known as Hatha Yoga.